Hi, I'm Rob Coleman. I'm the creative director for Industrial Light and Magic, Sydney, Australia.
How did you start your career in animation?
Well, my story starts when I was very, very little. My parents had a 16mm projector, and they would put movies on for us on the weekends. This is before VHS and way before DVDs and things like that. So I remember, I have an early memory, it was probably something like 5 years old. I remember my dad pulling up the 16mm, and I could see all the little images, and then threading the projector, and then us sitting watching movies. And back then you could rent, like, I remember watching Dumbo at home, and knowing somewhere in my head that there was a series of drawings, but they come to life magically from the projector. So I was fascinated with that. Let me fast forward, and I don't know when I saw Mary Poppins, but I was young, and there was Dick Van Dyke, who I knew was a real man, but he's dancing with penguins, and to me, that was just magic. That was absolute magic, because I was, like most kids, I loved animation, but here was live action and animation together sharing the screen. And then we fast forward, and I'm 13 years old, and Star Wars comes out, and that my brain just went boof. I was like, wow. And so we fast forward, I got interested in animation, I got interested in early computer graphics. I grew up in Canada. There's two major, or back then there was two major animation packages, Softimage out of Montreal and Alias out of Toronto. As it turned out, ILM used Alias to build the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, and they animated them Softimage. So when I saw Jurassic in 1993, I was like, I was animating professionally, I knew both packages, I knew ILM was doing it, so I applied and I got hired in October of 93. So I started 31 years ago at ILM as, I think, the ninth animator, computer graphics animator there.
What was your approach in working on the CG film Transformers 1, which is inspired by the original 2D animated series from the 80s?
Well, I mean, my first introduction with this film was talking to Josh Cooley back in November of 2021. He told me at that point that when he was young, he was a big fan of the 1980s Transformers, and he had the toys and he played with them. I knew about Josh because of Toy Story 4, so I knew he was a great filmmaker. So for us at ILM, it was about listening to Josh's vision of what he wanted, so inspired by the 80s, design of the simplistic faces of those cartoons, but bringing that into 3D computer graphics in a style that I refer to as stylized realism.
How did you approach the expressions and their translation from 2D to 3D?
Well, one of the other things Josh told me in our first conversations was he wanted to make sure that we had expressive faces that we could do non-verbal acting, meaning non-speaking. So our modeling and design team came up with all the kind of muscle controls that we have, but our robots don't have muscles. They had this malleable metal faces so that we could do frowns and smiles and surprise. But we didn't have eyes like our eyes. So we spent some time figuring out the mechanics of the inner eye, the spinning of the little interior pieces, kind of like a camera. And then we had these little shutters that we used to make sad eyes or angry eyes or surprised eyes. So there were design realities that we had to figure out. How do we get a human expression out of a robotic face? Now, it's a robotic face that is very much a human in design.
How did you create the transformations?
So our designer, Amy Christensen-Smith from ILM San Francisco, she was given the task to actually design all the characters in the movie. Now, she was the right choice because she's a massive Transformers fan from when she was a little girl. And she has a modeling background. So she designed the Transformers on paper first, or digitally. Then she translated them into three dimensions on her own system so that she could figure out how each of the pieces could go from bipedal mode, standing mode, to vehicle mode, and with no cheats. So because Josh had said he wanted the most important first transformations to happen in single shots, no cutting away, no cheats on scaling things. So Amy figured that all out over a series of weeks and months, gave all that data to ILM, and then we built the real assets for the movie.
Sometimes the transformations are fast, sometimes epic and slow. Did you use the same approach to create them?
Yeah, look, you're right. The reality is the first transformations happen in almost slow motion, and that is so that the audience and the fans of Transformers can see it happen. But once they've seen that happen once or twice, there's no need to linger on that anymore. So the animation process is exactly the same. We're moving the pieces in the same way, but we're taking way less time to do it. So later in the movie, they can just go and they can do it really quickly because the audience understands the mechanics of what's happening and we don't need to spend that time anymore. So that was a directorial decision and it made complete sense to me.
Did you also consider the Transformers from the live-action movies as references?
Well, so Josh had always wanted this to be an origin story. So how does Orion Pax and D16, how do they grow up and then diverge because of their differing worldviews? But one of the main things was that this movie was going to take place 100% on Cybertron. No Earth, no human beings. So where the other Transformers, that I'll call them the live-action visual effects ones, there's a certain amount of having to fit in with human scale and human-sized vehicles. So the Transformers are massive and needed to live in that world. For us on this movie, and it was a conscious decision, was we didn't have any of that we had to line up. We didn't have to line up to a street, or a real car or anything like that. So I can only imagine, because I wasn't there the early part, is that Josh Cooley then talked to Jason Shire, the production designer, and gave him that freedom and said, okay, design me Cybertron. What does Cybertron look like? What's the color palette? What's the metallic surfaces look like? And then now let's design characters that fit into that design Cybertron world, whether it be Icon City or the stadium or whatever, because you're designing concurrently. Jason's designing the environments and Amy's designing the characters, and the two have to feel like they're in the same universe and the same thing. And so those are all choices that were made. I love the look of it when they when they presented us the artwork. It looks fantastic.
Can you tell us about Virtual Story Reel and how you use motion capture?
Yeah, so the process on all films is you can start with storyboards and then you go into what we call previs, and then you go into layout and then animation. And that takes some time to do. If you've got people drawing storyboards for your action or your acting scenes. The producer on this film, Aaron Dem, came to ILM and said, I want to speed up that process and I want the result of that to be something that's easier for our test audiences to interact with. Meaning, you're not just looking at pencil drawings of characters, you're actually getting rendered versions of the environment and the character with some limited facial so that we can tell who's talking. Because a lot of the previs, it's just still images and you can't tell who's talking and it's not very clear sometimes. So in coming to ILM, he said, are you guys able to do real-time body and facial motion capture that we can, well, the term we use is block out a scene. Blocking out a scene is you figure where the actors are going to be, whether they're walking or talking, and they stop and camera looks over one shoulder and looks at the other. That's the blocking phase. In being able to work quickly and just having four actors happening in real time, and we can see real people here, but just off to the side on a screen are rendered, real-time renders, it looks like the Transformers. The director can then figure out his camera angle, figure out if he wants it closer, further away, and then we can generate all that footage real-time and send it to their editorial, and they can cut the scene together the next day. So it's very fast. But in doing that, Josh said, I want to do it, but I don't want to use any of that motion capture in the movie, because what he didn't want was he didn't want the robots to look like they were just people wearing costumes. They were designed so no one could stand inside them. Their waists are tiny. So he wanted a handcrafted, keyframed animation, which is what we did on the film. So we ultimately threw away the mocap, but it was extremely valuable and very rapid to build up the scenes before we got into animation.
Also to convey emotions in the right way.
Yeah, because here was Josh working with real people, so he could say, oh, I want you to play the scene more, you're physically more tired, or you're more agitated, and he could see that in real time. Where if you're getting a storyboard artist, they can do beautiful still drawings, but you're not feeling that body movement. when motion capture, you're getting that, and you say, no, let's go again. And it's your 30 seconds later, you got another take, and then another take. So it was, I think a lot of people on the show found it a really interesting and quick way to get to the style of the motion that we wanted.
You also worked on the Lego Movie. What are the differences in making movies about toys?
Well, so yes, I was the head of animation on the Lego Movie, and I was the animation supervisor on Lego Batman. In the case of the Lego films, the directors, Lord and Miller, had on the Lego Movie, had come to us and said they wanted to tap into what it was like to play with their Lego when they were young. And so if you imagine me holding onto a minifig, we tended to make them walk on a table. We tend to go like, you know, tack, 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 or back and forth. So we approached the animation with the idea that there's an invisible hand holding on to the Lego pieces and moving them around. So a Lego piece could pop up in the air and say its line and then pop down again, because you would play that way. Transformers, we didn't animate them as if they were toys. We animated them as if they were humans. And I know that there are toys, but in this case, we didn't lean into the making them toyetic. We made them like they were the size of you and me.
While in Transformers 1 there are transformations, in the Lego Movie there were constructions. How did you approach those animations?
Yeah, well, on the Lego films, we came up with a whole, because there's no motion blur in the Lego Movie, so we created what we called brick blur. So if Emmett moved really quickly, we would put bricks of the same color as his trousers or his top behind him to make it look like a blur. Like when you go like that, you get a blur. And when we were either building something up quickly with Lego or tearing it down with Lego, we were also thinking about what it was like to do that on if we were shooting at stop motion animation. So there are, you can look them up online. There are lots of people who do what they're called brick films. They're with real bricks and they shoot them with their iPhone or whatever. And you're just putting a brick down and you're taking a frame, and then you move the brick and take a frame. And when you play it back, they move around. So it's just this, what we call stop motion animation. So when we were emulating that in computer graphics, but we were very much trying to make it look like brick films. In the Transformer films, the goal was, and we achieved it, was to have all the pieces of the bipedal model match, so that you could spin them and twist them and click them back together to make the vehicle mode of them. So we had Transformers toys at work, and we could see how the actual toys do it. So you pull it apart, you spin the legs around, they fold this way, the head. There's a panel, it pops up, head goes in, you click it over. So we looked at how is it actually in the toy, how does Optimus Prime go from his prime shape to his truck mode? What are the pieces and what are the order that you do that? We certainly followed that. We certainly looked at that and did the sequential changes so it looked like the toy, what the toy would look like if you're playing with it.
How have you seen the animation industry evolve over the years?
Oh, there's been so many evolutions, but at the core of it, an animator, whether they were working on the earliest Disney films or the Warner Brothers cartoons or Jurassic Park or what we're doing now, we're all creating, and this phrase is well used, we're creating the illusion of life. Animation is really just a series of still images. But the illusion is that if we do our job right as talented animators, the character that we're animating comes to life in front of the audience. And they believe that it's alive, that it's thinking, that it's emoting. And if we really are good at our job, we can evoke tears and laughter and connection. And that's the magic. And that hasn't changed since the early days. You know, Snow White, they were doing that. We're doing it now, and there's been so much time in between. So the goal of and the excellence of an animator back then and the excellence of an animator now, you're judged for the same things. Does the audience believe the character you're animating is alive? And if you've done that, you've done well.
What is your personal definition of animation?
Well, my personal definition of animation is the illusion of life. It's to breathe your own humanity through your own world experience into your characters. So that can be, how do they walk? How do they talk? How do they present themselves? And I think the best animators lean on, that they're great observers of life. So either they've experienced themselves or they've watched others and they see things that they want to use in the performance. Because what I'm always trying to get out of my animators is that we have the script, we have the voice track. That's what we call the text. That's the text of the scene. But what's going on inside the character's head is the subtext. Where were they 5 minutes ago? What do they want in this scene? Do they believe in what they're hearing from the character that they're listening to? In real life, we see this all the time. We can tell if someone's paying attention to us or not. We can see there's something they're not as happy as I would hope that, you know, they would be. There's something going on in the inside. When we do our job really well as animators, we get on the inside and it comes out and our audience sees it and recognizes it because we experience this all our life as human beings.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.